Today we have, as we are honored to have as our guest, a gentleman whose fame has extended. He's the most stimulating and articulate speaker. He was born in New York City, and he grew up in France and England, where he received his early childhood education. On his return to New York State, he attended the Millbrook School in Millbrook, New York. He later graduated from Yale University with honors in 1950. In 1951, he wrote his first book entitled God and Man at Yale. This book was in reference to what he regarded as Yale's political and irreligion liberalism. In his second book, McCarthy and His Enemies, he attacked Senator Joseph McCarthy, McCarthy's anti-communist, to provide a forum for his conservative opinion. He founded the National Review in 1955. From the early 1960s to the present, his career has included a race for mayor of New York City against John Lindsay, hosting of the syndicated television program Firing Line, where he debated with liberals and radicals on issues of today. He was a president appointee to the 28th General Assembly of the United Nations and the Advisory Commission on the Information of the United States Information Agency. He has written numerous books and articles on the topic conservatism and received many outstanding awards and degrees in journalism and television. He describes himself, and I quote, "I am a radical conservative." Ladies and gentlemen, from one conservative to another, Mr. William Frank Buckley, Jr.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you, Mr. Burke, for the very eloquent introduction. I don't intend to run for public office, but in case I do, don't lose that introduction, will you? I'm very happy to be here again. I was the guest of this institution during a very tumultuous day in the middle of the Vietnam War, which your administration was perverse enough to celebrate by inviting me to speak. In any event, your hospitable reception is in welcome contrast to an experience earlier this week at Eau Claire, Wisconsin, where at 7 o'clock in the morning, the telephone rang in my suite at the Howard Johnson Motel. The operator said that the district attorney was on the line, should she put him through. I did a quick examination of conscience and said, well, go ahead. And I recognized right away the unmistakable accents of an old friend, a classmate I hadn't seen in many years, a Democrat of invincible ignorance, who said, Bill, the only reason I called you up was to tell you that you're occupying the identical suite occupied by Al Capp 5 years ago when he tried to rape a co-ed, and what are you doing in town? It's pretty early in the morning for polemical exchanges, but I did remember that my friend, the district attorney, had been the chairman of the Lyndon Johnson for President movement in Wisconsin in 1964, So I thought it, under the circumstances, a little bit risky for him to make references, however oblique, to Republican cupidity. I reminded him, or so the story goes, of the meeting with between President Johnson, his two guests, in the Oval Office shortly after his triumphant victory, to which he had contributed, to which my friend had contributed, where it is said he leaned back and, looking at Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton in the Oval Office, leaned back expansively in his chair and said, "Just think, between the three of us, we've probably screwed the majority of the American people." My friend, the district attorney, asked my advice about accepting an appointment to the United Nations legal staff, knowing that I had served briefly in the United Nations. I warned him that he would have to undergo a very rigorous FBI investigation in order to qualify, and reminded him and myself of the FBI agent who called my colleague Bill Rusher in 1973 when I was appointed delegate to the United Nations. Bill Rusher groaned on hearing the usual questions. He said, "We went through this in 1969 when Mr. Buckley went to USIA. I know, said the FBI agent, "but I'm required to find out whether Mr. Buckley might have done anything since 1969 to embarrass President Nixon." "No," said Bill Rusher, "but President Nixon's done a great deal to embarrass Mr. Buckley." I also told him, as some of you no doubt know, others of you will in due course discover, that when you get one of those appointments after you're confirmed by the Senate, eventually a huge scroll arrives at your house. It begins with the name of the President of the United States and continues in exquisite calligraphy, with four blank spaces, one for your name, one for the office to which you've been appointed. A third is for the length of the appointment. And the fourth is introduced by the stock words, "in recognition of : after which was written in on my scroll, "his intelligence and integrity." I thought it was very nice that the president knew about my intelligence and integrity. But I found myself wondering, as perhaps you would under similar circumstances after a while, what was the inventory of characterizations from which those two had been selected? The lawyers have a phrase, inclusio unius est exclusio alterius, that is to say, you draw attention to that which you don't name by that which you do name. I forgot about it, but for a few months later I was in Saigon talking to Ambassador Bunker, who was called out of his office, and I spotted his scroll hanging in a corner of his office, and I tiptoed over to see what was written down in his blank space. And then I saw, "in recognition of his intelligence, integrity, and prudence." It was undoubtedly imprudent of me to accept an invitation to attempt to define conservatism for you, specifically to distinguish genuine conservatism from kook conservatism, or so the invitation read. Imprudent because it is extremely difficult, if not impossible, to define conservatism. Conservatism has to be more or less experienced. Professor Richard, the late Professor Richard Weaver of the University of Chicago, a man of great personal shyness and modesty, was once pressed by a student to come up with a definition of conservatism. And he kept saying that it was not possible to do. But finally, after five or ten relentless minutes of probing, Professor Weaver said, well, he said, conservatism is a paradigm of essences towards which the phenomenology of the world is in continuing approximation. That's the kind of thing that happens when you ask what conservatism means. Professor Weaver was as entitled as anyone of his generation to attempt a definition of conservatism, having contributed so much to its cultural structure. And what he said was actually extraordinarily illuminating. A paradigm of essences suggests that there is something about conservatism that doesn't change. But when he conjoined to essences which are unchangeable, the notion of phenomenology, which is experience, he married to the abstraction, the empirical. And by suggesting that the phenomenology of the world was in continuing approximation, he also reminded us that conservatism is anti-utopian, i.e., it can approximate the ideal of the form, but it can never achieve it. The notion that conservatism consists merely in defending the status quo runs you into the obvious difficulties. Thus, one reads in the New York Times about the conservatives in the Kremlin, and the conservatives in the Kremlin are the Stalinists. Something is obviously wrong, it would seem, with a definition of conservatism so latitudinarian as to include Stalin among its members. The New York Times got into real problems of a terminological sort a couple of years ago when one dispatch from Moscow found itself saying that the conservatives in the Kremlin were cracking down on the random importation of American books into the Soviet Union, and that among the books that was now formally excluded was The Conscience of a Conservative by Barry Goldwater. The paradox there becomes obvious, but is obvious in any event. When people speak about the conservatives in Peking, they mean nowadays tend to mean nowadays the Maoists. There is very little resemblance, obviously, between conservatism used in that sense and conservatism used in the sense in which it is used here in the United States. Under the circumstances, it has got to suggest more than merely the defense of the status quo, or more frequently, the status quo ante. It is, I think, above all things, conservatism is the politics of reality. It is opposed to ideological constructions. It is opposed to abstract social impositions on society based on visions. And yet at the same time, it is meliorist in the sense that it desires to improve the nature of social reality, but to do so consistent with a natural development of institutions and consistent with the unchangeable nature of man. About 20 years ago, the unreality of liberal economics began to be challenged rather systematically. It had, of course, during the preceding generation been resisted. Some of the hallucinations of economic liberalism, defined here as the kind of liberalism that was promulgated by the supporters of Franklin Roosevelt and some of the more ardent supporters of Keynes, to say nothing of the supporters of a more extreme liberalism, which developed into a kind of Fabian socialism, began to be challenged as at a particular level. I remember 1958, when during the closing days of the campaign, it looked as though Nelson Rockefeller would in fact unseat Governor Averell Harriman, who was running for re-election. So in the closing days of that campaign, thinking to lose against Nelson Rockefeller the single most damaging political insinuation that you can drop in New York politics, Harriman suggested that if Nelson Rockefeller were elected governor of the state of New York, the subway fare would rise. Nelson Rockefeller hired himself a few television stations for a talkathon in order to rebut so heinous a charge as that he would raise that he would permit the fares to be raised beyond the 10 cents then being charged. He did face certain constitutional and intellectual difficulties. The constitutional difficulty was that he had no formal authority to decide what the subway fare would be, because when they were municipalized two generations earlier, they were municipalized under an indenture that required that the expenses be paid for by income, i.e. that there should be no external economic factor intruding on the determination of price. His political difficulty was that there was nobody around on whom the rising cost of the subway could be profitably charged. There were no capitalists in the picture. There were no bloated stockholders, because of course the subways were owned by the city. And the whole of the income was devoted merely to paying the expenses of their operation. Nevertheless, Governor Rockefeller, then Nelson Rockefeller, said that if he was governor, he would somehow contrive to see that there would be no rise in the subway fares. In due course, he was elected, and something had to be done, so he fussed around and broke the indenture by some contrivance or another. And in effect, using of course a symbol, he went to the taxpayers of Cayuga County and had them ship money down for the benefit of the 10 million subway riders of New York City. This money of course was gratefully received. But in due course, it set up a psychic sense of a reciprocal obligation. And before very long, the subway riders of New York City found themselves paying higher taxes for the benefit of Cayuga County apple pickers, more or less requiting the favor. At the very same year, at a different level, much the same thing was happening happening at a federal state level. In that same year, Albany, having voted a capital increase for the building of schools every year since the Second World War, said this year we're not going to vote a capital increase. There is we have to stop and rest on the seventh day before we go back and raise taxes yet again for another increase in capital or expenditures. So all the people's representatives in Albany turned down the proposed educational bills, but all the representatives in Washington, representing the same set of voters, voted federal aid to education. Now, since in those days, for every dollar received from Washington by New York, $1.65 was being sent from New York to Washington by elementary economic analysis. Simultaneously to vote in favor of federal aid to education and against state aid to education was a gesture either of masochism or philanthropy. The fact of the matter is, of course, that most voters were not encouraged by the politicians to understand it as either. They understood it rather as tapping a resource that was infinitely, copiously there, available for the use of voters in New York who desire something and desire simultaneously not to pay for it. Before long, as one can see, the sky becomes blackened by crisscrossing dollars, some running down to Washington, others running back from Washington, and of course, as we all know, any dollar dispatched to Washington, even if only with round-trip instructions, is going to spend an expensive night out on the town while in Washington. It became clear, really, that there were two planted axioms in liberal economics. The first is that the dollar that issues out of Washington, D.C. is spontaneously generated. And the second, the corollary, really is that a dollar is virtuously deployed insofar as you elongate the distance between where it is collected and where it is spent. So that a dollar that originates in Dutchess County and is spent on educating Indians in New Mexico is for some reason a dollar with a more praiseworthy mission than a dollar that is locally collected in New Mexico for the education of Indians in New Mexico. Now, this economic surrealism became, during the late 50s and continues even today, to be a major focus of conservatives who insist that the surrealism of liberal economics stands between the people and their recognition of reality. The distinction was aptly put, interestingly enough, by a socialist, more properly, I would say, a repentant socialist. He is now the ambassador from Great Britain to Washington, who in a recent essay said that the critical distinction between the approach to the people of the politician and of the economist is that the politician says to the people, "What do you want?" Whereas the economist says to the people, "What do you want most?" Embedded in that distinction is the meaning of realism. If one wants increased education, one has to pay for it. If one wants lunch, one has to pay for it. If one wants a defensive apparatus, one has to pay for it. And yet the notion that the spontaneously generated dollar is going to finance much of what it is that our society requires has been a notion prodigiously cultivated by a class of politicians who are not sympathetic to the politics of reality, who are responsible, indeed, for much of the public confusion when all of a sudden one turns around and finds the richest city in the world has gone bankrupt. The scale on which this confusion has gone forward is suggested by recent studies having to do with the entire cost of redistribution. There are 31 states in America whose income is above the median, and 19 states whose income is below the median. So that the whole logic of redistribution is, of course, to take from the wealthier states for the benefit of the less wealthy states. There is obviously no point at all in assigning to the federal government a responsibility that can be discharged locally. In the year 1971, in the welfare budget, $278 million was sent by the state of Missouri to Washington, and $278 million was sent by Washington to the state of Missouri. Raising, of course, the question, why did the state of Missouri need Washington's intercession in order to describe its own welfare program? The figures for 1971 show this remarkable fact that there was only a 9% net redistribution. That is to say, only 9% of all the billions and billions of welfare dollars that flowed into Washington ended up back in states that hadn't contributed it in the first instance. In other words, that less than 10% of the entire federal welfare budget is an exercise in auto-taxation, is an exercise in a continuation of the politics of hallucination, which is the substance of so much of what passes for sophisticated liberal politics. It has been a movement towards that realism that has fired a number of conservative political analysts who have challenged some of the postulates of economic liberalism. Even John Kenneth Galbraith recognizes that much that was taken for granted by economic liberalism is nowadays challenged. As recently as last January, giving an interview in London, he confessed to the reporter that, as he put it 15 years ago, I and my colleagues at Harvard were quite certain that we had the answers to all of the critical questions involving economics. Now, we know that there is a great deal to be learned. If there is a great deal for other economists to learn, we can imagine a fortiori how much there is left for John Kenneth Galbraith to learn. But, of course, to be dogmatic is part of his endearing style. I was with him last week at lunch trying to figure out a date in our calendar when we could discharge a commitment to a network. I suggested the first week in December. He looked at his calendar and said, no. He said, the first week in December I'll be lecturing at the University of Moscow. Oh, I said, what do you have left to teach them? But then I suppose as long as he is giving economic advice to the Soviet Union, at least we will have a market for our excess grain. Along with this gradual penetration of the surrealisms of liberal economics, conservatism was advancing on another front. That front was a reapprehension of the relationship between economic freedom and other freedom. I say reapprehension because it was a very ancient insight. Jefferson had said, remember that the government can only do something for the people in proportion as it can do something to the people. President Adams had warned that it is, as he put it, the habit of the state to turn every contingency into an excuse for aggrandizing power within itself. Woodrow Wilson, in his book on Congress and constitutional government, back when liberalism meant what it used to mean, said, the history of liberalism is the history of man's efforts to restrain the growth of government. But they had latterly, during the last two, three generations, come this huge enthusiasm for the growth of the public sector without a commensurate apprehension of the dangers of this growth to the survival of individual freedom. For some reason, whereas it was always easy to explain to anybody that if you work 100% of the time for the state, you're a slave, it was never easy to explain that if you work 95% of the time for the state, you are, to a considerable extent, indentured to it. There were many devices by which that relationship was obscured. For instance, the money that is automatically withdrawn from the paycheck, causing less and less of a public focus on the expenses of government. But conservatism was there to reassert the notion that a superabundance of economic power and authority given to the government must mean a diminution in social power. And the principle of subsidiarity was revived. The principle of subsidiarity says very simply this, that the public sector should never take on a responsibility that can be discharged by the private sector, but that if a responsibility cannot be taken on and discharged by the private sector and is taken on by the public sector, it should never be taken on by a higher public unit than necessary. Thus, the federal government ought not to attempt what an individual state can do, and a state ought not to attempt what a community can do. It was only Christmas before last that we saw the direction in which we were suddenly headed. Here, the secretary of HEW disposing of $90 billion per year, as much money as was spent for the entire federal budget during the first 165 years of the nation's existence, gave an interview to Newsweek magazine towards the end of the year, and he said, do you know what I spent Christmas Day deciding? No, said the reporter, he didn't know what he spent Christmas Day deciding. Well, he said, there were two urgent administrative questions that had been raised on which I had to make a decision. The first is, can old people who are living in old people's homes, which are in part subsidized by federal funds, can they go home and visit their children twice a year for 3 weeks each, or just once a year for 6 weeks. Because under one interpretation of the law, if they are mobile enough to make two round trips to visit their children per year, they really aren't immobile enough to qualify for subsidized treatment in old people's homes. So this is one of the decisions I have to make, of whether old people can travel twice a year at home for 3 weeks each, or 1 year. He said the other one is, what do I do if not enough girls at the University of Arizona elect to play baseball? Because under one interpretation of the law, if not as many girls as boys turn out for baseball, I must withdraw all HEW subsidies to the University of Arizona on the grounds that we violate Title VI of the 1967 Civil Rights Code. To this ridiculous extreme are we driven for failure to guard against the excessive growth of the public sector, which saps now 44% of all the money that is made by all the citizens of the United States. It was de Tocqueville who predicted that the end of freedom in the United States would not come as a result of a dictator suddenly emerging, as a result of a massive suspension of the Bill of Rights. It would come, said he, by the action of little capillaries that will surround and drown out, by little bureaucratic regulations, a true freedom of mobility, which America, he predicted over 100 years ago, then experiences. I think of the story of the timid man who went to his tailor to order a suit, came back 3 weeks later, put it on, and found that the right cuff was 4 inches above the ground. So he turned to the tailor after summoning the courage to complain and said, "Have you noticed my right cuff?" The tailor turned to him and said, "Well, just bend your right knee when you walk and it will adjust itself perfectly." So he did that and he said, "Well, but have you noticed that this causes a distortion in my left hip, a bulge?" And they said, "Well, just shove it out to the left as you walk and you will compensate for it." At this point, he was discouraged, paid his bill, and walked down the street. Two men passed him, and after they were at a safe distance removed from him, one said to the other, "Did you notice that poor cripple walking down the street?" And the other one said, "Yes, but did you notice what a beautifully fitting suit of clothes he had on?" The conservative perception of the dangers of overaction, of a swollen bureaucracy, of a gargantuan state, took the form among a small group of conservatisms who took it to a fanatical length. A conservative's favorite word ought to be presumption. There is a presumption against assigning a responsibility to the public sector. But remember, presumptions can be rebutted under certain circumstances. A responsibility can only be discharged by the public sector, and it is proper under those circumstances to do this. Some conservatism, call them kooks, if you will, since I feel obliged to use the word, that having been a part of my assignment, took that word, as I say, to an extreme, to a fanatical extreme. How do you define fanaticism? Here is how Oliver Wendell Holmes did it. He said, "Look, everybody agrees that you own the air above your own house, such that, for instance, you have the authority to prevent your neighbor from arching his roof and building an extension on over on top of your roof. He said, but the fanatic, will take that commonly understood ownership of the air above your roof and extend it to a shaft of air that stretches up into the Milky Way, such that no airplane or child's kite can overfly it. That is a fanatical extension of a right that is presumed and commonly accepted. And thus arose that little band of anarchists associated, for instance, with the work of Ayn Rand, associated with the work of Murray Rothbard, who really denied the authority of the state to undertake any function whatsoever. There is a sense in which anarchists are both charming and useful. If we spend our nights in hectic discussions on whether we should defederalize the lighthouses, it is unlikely that we will spend nights wondering whether to federalize the medical profession. In that sense, the paradigm is useful, but it is also correct that the dangers of anarchy are dangers that lead to a complete breakdown of order, and the first casualty in the breakdown of order, as many students experienced as recently as six and seven and eight years ago, is the freedom of anybody at all. Whitaker Chambers, reviewing the book Atlas Shrugged for National Review 1957, detected the strain, that curious authoritarian dyspeptic strain in a strident anarchism, which was excreted by the conservative movement and continues now its own life in the ideological fever swamps. Whitaker Chambers wrote of Atlas Shrugged, the book's dictatorial tone is its most striking feature. Out of a lifetime of reading, I can recall no other book in which a tone of overriding arrogance was so implacably sustained. Its shrillness is without reprieve. Then, detecting, as I say, that ideology that requires the rejection of anarchism, Chambers wrote, the same inflexibly self-righteous stance results in odd extravagances of inflection and gesture. At first, we try to tell ourselves that these are just lapses, that this mind has somehow mislaid the discriminating knack that most of us pray will warn us in time of the difference between what is effective and firm and what is wildly grotesque and excessive. Soon, we suspect something worse. We suspect that this mind finds precisely in extravagance some exalting merit, feels a surging release of power and passion precisely in smashing up the house. And it is, I think, correct that fanatical wing from the conservative house ended up in its excessive attraction to the anti-statist position in smashing up the house, smashing up the paradigm itself. It was, however, successfully rejected and claims now no honored or pedigreed relationship to a plausible conservatism. Much collateral scholarship was going on during the time at a cultural level. Richard Weaver, I've already mentioned, Richard Weaver was interested in what it is that causes communities to work. What is the sensitivity that you are obliged to have towards each other, towards me, I towards you. What is it that breeds that sensitivity? How do we learn about the necessity for institutional media that stand between us and the state, between us and a wild application of the public will? Leo Strauss, the great scholar, was reminding us of the relevance of the great tradition, insisting that the great enemy of true learning was that logical positivism which insists that there is